Chapter 4 Hides 1 They had to go fireless 3 nights instead of 1 or 2. The last was the longest, most wretched 12 hours of Susanna's life. Is it worse than the night Eddie died? She asked herself at one point. Are you really saying this is worse than lying awake in one of those dormitory rooms, knowing that was how you'd be lying from then on? Worse than washing his face and hands and feet? Washing them for the ground? Yes, this was worse. She hated knowing it, and would never admit it to anyone else, but the deep, endless cold of that last night was far worse. She came to dread every light breath of breeze from the snowlands to the east and south. It was both terrible and oddly humbling to realize how easily physical discomfort could take control, expanding like poison gas until it owned all the floor space, took over the entire playing field. Grief? Loss? What were those things when you could feel cold on the march, moving in from your fingers and toes, crawling up your motherfucking nose, and moving where? Toward the brain, do it please you. And toward the heart. In the grip of cold like that, grief and loss were nothing but words. No, not even that, only sounds. So much meaningless quack as you sat shuddering under the stars, waiting for a morning that would never come. What made it worse was knowing there were potential bonfires all around them, for they'd reached the live region Roland called the Undersnow. This was a series of long, grassy slopes, most of the grass now white and dead, and shallow valleys where there were isolated stands of trees and brooks now plugged with ice. Earlier, in daylight, Roland had pointed out several holes in the ice and told her they'd been made by deer. He pointed out several piles of scat as well. In daylight, such sign had been interesting, even hopeful. But in this endless ditch of night, listening to the steady, low click of her chattering teeth, it meant nothing. Eddie meant nothing. Jake neither. The dark tower meant nothing, nor did the bonfire they'd had out the outskirts of Castletown. She could remember the look of it, but the feel of heat warming her skin until it brought an oil of sweat was utterly lost. Like a person who has died for a moment or two and has briefly visited some shining afterlife, she could only say that it had been wonderful. Roland sat with his arms around her, sometimes voicing a dry, harsh cough. Susanna thought he might be getting sick, but this thought also had no power, only the cold. Once, shortly before dawn finally began to stain the sky in the east, this was, she saw orange lights swirl dancing far ahead, past the place where the snow began. She asked Roland if he had any idea what they were. She had no real interest, but hearing her voice reassured her that she wasn't dead. Not yet, at least. I think they're Hobbs.
What are they?
She now stuttered and stammered everything. I don't know how to explain them to you, he said. And there's really no need. You'll see them in time. Right now, if you listen, you'll hear something closer and more interesting. At first she heard only the sigh of the wind. Then it dropped, and her ears picked up the dry swish of the grass below as something walked through it. This was followed by a low, crunching sound. Susanna knew exactly what it was. A hoof, stamping through thin ice, opening the running water to the cold world above. She also knew that in 3 or 4 days' time, she might be wearing a coat made from the animal that was now drinking nearby, but this also had no meaning. Time was a useless concept when you were sitting awake in the dark and in constant pain. Had she thought she had been cold before? That was quite funny, wasn't it?
What about Mordred? She asked. Is he out there, do you think?
Yes.
And does he feel the cold, like we do?
I don't know.
I can't stand much more of this, Roland. I really can't.
You won't have to. It'll be dawn soon. And I expect we'll have a fire tomorrow, come dark. He coughed into his fist, then put his arm back around her. You'll feel better once we're up and in the doings. Meantime, at least we're together. 2. Mordred was as cold as they were, every bit, and he had no one. He was close enough to hear them, though. Not the actual words, but the sound of their voices. He shuddered uncontrollably and had lined his mouth with dead grass when he became afraid that Roland's sharp ears might pick up the sound of his chattering teeth. The railway man's jacket was no help. He had thrown it away when it had fallen into so many pieces that he could no longer hold it together. He'd worn the arms of it out of Castletown, but then they had fallen to pieces as well, starting at the elbows, and he'd cast them into the low grass beside the old road with a petulant curse. He was only able to go on wearing the boots because he'd been able to weave long grass into a rough twine. With it, he'd bound what remained of them to his feet. He'd considered changing back to his spider form, knowing that body would feel the cold less. But his entire short life had been plagued by the specter of starvation, and he supposed that part of him would always fear it, no matter how much food he had at hand. The gods knew there wasn't much now. 3 severed arms, 4 legs, 2 partially eaten, and a piece of a torso from the wicker basket, that was all. If he changed, the spider would gobble that little bit up by daylight. And while there was game out here, he heard the deer moving around just as clearly as his white daddy did. Mordred wasn't entirely confident of his ability to trap it or run it down. So he sat and shivered and listened to the sound of their voices until the voices ceased. Maybe they slept. He might have dozed a little himself. And the only thing that kept him from giving up and going back was his hatred of them. That they should have each other. When he had no one. No one at all. "Mordred's a hungry," he thought miserably. "Mordred's a cold. And Mordred has no one. Mordred's alone." He slipped his wrist into his mouth, bit deep, and sucked the warmth that flowed out. In the blood, he tasted the last of Rando Thoughtful's life, but so little, so soon gone. And once it was, there was nothing but the useless, recycled taste of himself. In the dark, Mordred began to cry. 3. 4 hours after dawn, under a white sky that promised rain or sleet, perhaps both at the same time, Susanna Dean lay shivering behind a fallen log, looking down into one of the little valleys. "You'll hear Oi," the gunslinger had told her. "And you'll hear me, too. I'll do what I can, but I'll be driving them ahead of me, and you'll have the best shooting. Make every shot count." What made things worse was her creeping intuition that Mordred was very close now, and he might try to bushwhack her while her back was turned. She kept looking around, but they had picked a relatively clear spot. And the open grass behind her was empty each time, save once, when she had seen a large brown rabbit lolloping along with its ears dragging the ground. At last, she heard Oi's high-pitched barking from the copse of trees on her left. A moment later, Roland began to yell, "Hiyah! Hiyah! Get on, brisk! Get on, brisk, I tell thee! Never tarry! Never tarry a single—" Then the sound of him coughing. She didn't like that cough. No. Not at all. Now she could see movement in the trees, and for one of the few times since Roland had forced her to admit there was another person hiding inside of her, she called on Detta Walker.
"I need you. If you want to be warm again, you settle my hands so I can shoot straight."
And the ceaseless shivering of her body stopped. As the herd of deer burst out of the trees, not a small herd either, there had to be at least 18 of them, led by a buck with a magnificent rack, her hands also stopped their shaking. In the right one, she held Roland's revolver with the sandalwood grips. Here came Oi, bursting out of the woods behind the final straggler. This was a muty doe, running, and with eerie grace, on 4 legs of varying sizes, with a 5th waggling bonelessly from the middle of her belly like a teat. Last of all came Roland, not really running at all, not anymore, but rather staggering onward at a grim jog. She ignored him, tracking the buck with the gun as the big fellow ran across her field of fire.
"This way," she whispered. "Break to your right, honey child. Let's see you do it. Kamala, come, come."
and while there was no reason why he should have, the buck leading his little fleeing herd did indeed veer slightly in Susanna's direction. Now she was filled with the sort of coldness she welcomed. Her vision seemed to sharpen until she could see the muscles rippling under the buck's hide, the white crescent as his eye rolled, the old wound on the nearest doe's foreleg where the fur had never grown back. She had a moment to wish Eddie and Jake were lying on either side of her, feeling what she was feeling, seeing what she was seeing, and then that was gone too.
"I do not kill with my gun. She who kills with her gun has forgotten the face of her father. I kill with my heart," she murmured, and began shooting.
The first bullet took the lead buck in the head, and he crashed over on his left side. The others ran past him. A doe leaped over his body, and Susanna's second bullet took her at the height of her leap, so that she crashed down dead on the other side, one leg splayed and broken, all grace gone. She heard Roland fire three times, but didn't look to see how he'd done. She had her own business to attend to, and she attended to it well. Each of the last four bullets in the cylinder took down a deer, and only one was still moving when he fell. It didn't occur to her that this was an amazing piece of shooting, especially with a pistol. She was a gunslinger after all, and shooting was her business. Besides, the morning was windless. Half the herd now lay dead in the grassy valley below. All the remainder, save one, wheeled left and pelted away downslope toward the stream. A moment later they were lost in a screen of willows. The last one, a yearling buck, ran directly toward her. Susanna didn't bother trying to reload from the little pile of bullets lying beside her on a square of buckskin, but took one of the riser plates instead, her hand automatically finding the dull gripping place.
"Riser!" she screamed and flung it.
It flew across the dry grass, elevating slightly as it did, giving off that weird moaning sound. It struck the racing buck at mid-neck. Droplets of blood flew in a garland around its head, black against the white sky. A butcher's cleaver could not have done a neater job. For a moment the buck ran on, heedless and headless, blood jetting from the stump of its neck as its racing heart gave up its last half a dozen beats. Then it crashed to its splayed forelegs less than 10 yards in front of her hide, staining the dry yellow grass a bright red. The previous night's long misery was forgotten. The numbness had departed her hands and her feet. There was no grief in her now, no sense of loss, no fear. For the moment, Susanna was exactly the woman that Ka had made her. The mixed smell of gunpowder and blood from the downed buck was bitter. It was also the world's sweetest perfume. Standing up straight on her stumps, Susanna spread her arms. Roland's pistol clenched in her right hand and made a Y against the sky. Then she screamed. There were no words in it, nor could there have been. Our greatest moments of triumph are always inarticulate. 4. Roland had insisted that they eat a huge breakfast, and her protests that cold corned beef tasted like so much lumpy mush cut zero ice with him. By 2 that afternoon, according to his fancy-schmancy pocket watch, right around the time the steady cold rain fattened into an icy drizzle, in other words, she was glad. She had never done a harder day of physical labor, and the day wasn't finished. Roland was by her all the while, matching her in spite of his worsening cough. She had time, during their brief but crazily delicious noon meal of seared deer steaks, to consider how strange he was, how remarkable. After all this time and all these adventures, she had still not seen the bottom of him, not even close. She had seen him laughing and crying, killing and dancing. She'd seen him sleeping and on the squat behind a screen of bushes with his pants down and his ass hung over what he called the log of ease. She'd never slept with him as a woman does with a man, but she thought she'd seen him in every other circumstance. And no, still no bottom. "That cough's sounding more and more like pneumonia to me," Susanna remarked, not long after the rain had started. They were then in the part of the day's activities Roland called Avenkar, carrying the kill and preparing to make it into something else. "Never let it worry you," Roland said. "I have what I need here to cure it.
say true?
She asked doubtfully. Yar, and these which I never lost. He reached into his pocket and showed her a handful of aspirin tablets. She thought the expression on his face was one of real reverence, and why not? It might be that he owed his life to what he called Aston. Aston and Chieflet. They loaded their kill into the back of Hofat's luxury taxi and dragged it down to the stream. It took 3 trips in all. After they'd stacked the carcasses, Roland carefully placed the head of the yearling buck atop the pile, where it looked at them from its glazed eyes.
"What you want that for?"
Susanna asked, with a trace of Detta in her voice. "We're going to need all the brains we can get," Roland said, and coughed dryly into his curled fist again. "It's a dirty way to do the job, but it's quick, and it works." 5. When they had their kill piled beside the icy stream, "At least we don't have the flies to worry about," Roland said. The gunslinger began gathering deadwood. Susanna looked forward to the fire, but her terrible need of the previous night had departed. She'd been working hard, and for the time being, at least, was warm enough to suit her. She tried to remember the depth of her despair, how the cold had crept into her bones, turning them to glass, and couldn't do it. Because the body had a way of forgetting the worst things, she supposed. And without the body's cooperation, all the brain had were memories like faded snapshots. Before beginning his wood-gathering chore, Roland inspected the bank of the icy stream and dug out a piece of rock. He handed it to her, and Susanna rubbed a thumb over its milky, water-smoothed surface.
"Quartz?"
she asked. But she didn't think it was, not quite. "I don't know that word, Susanna. We call it chert. It makes tools that are primitive but plenty useful. Axe heads, knives, skewers, scrapers. It's scrapers we'll want, also at least one hand hammer."
"I know what we're going to scrape, but what are we going to hammer?"
"I'll show you, but first, will you join me here for a moment?" Roland got down on his knees and took her cold hand in one of his. Together they faced the deer's head. "We thank you for what we are about to receive," Roland told the head, and Susanna shivered. It was exactly how her father began when he was giving the grace before a big meal, one where all the family was gathered.
"Our own family is broken," she thought,
but did not say. Done was done. The response she gave was the one she had been taught as a young girl.
"Father, we thank thee.
Guide our hands, and guide our hearts as we take life from death," Roland said. Then he looked at her, eyebrows raised, asking without speaking a word if she had more to say. Susanna found that she did.
"Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. Lead us not into temptation. Deliver us from evil. Thou art the kingdom, and the power, and the glory, now and forever."
"That's a lovely prayer," he said.
"Yes," she agreed. "I didn't say it just right. It's been a long time, but it's still the best prayer. Now let's do our business while I can still feel my hands."
Roland gave her an amen. 6. Roland took the severed head of the yearling deer, the antler nubs made lifting it easy, set it in front of him, then swung the fist-sized chunk of rock against the skull. There was a muffled cracking sound that made Susanna's stomach cringe. Roland gripped the antlers and pulled, first left and then right. When Susanna saw the way the broken skull wiggled under the hide, her stomach did more than cringe. It did a slow loop-the-loop. Roland hit twice more, wielding the piece of chert with near-surgical precision. Then he used his knife to cut a circle in the head hide, which he pulled off like a cap. This revealed the cracked skull beneath. He worked the blade of his knife into the widest crack and used it as a lever. When the deer's brain was exposed, he took it out, set it carefully aside, and looked at Susanna. We'll want the brains of every deer we killed. And that's what we need a hammer for.
Oh, she said in a choked voice. Brains.
To make a tanning slurry. But there's more use for chert than that. Look. He showed her how to bang two chunks together until one or both shattered, leaving large, nearly even pieces instead of jagged lumps. She knew that metamorphic rocks broke that way, but schists and such were generally too weak to make good tools. This stuff was strong. When you get chunks that break thick enough to hold on one side but thin to an edge on the other, Roland said, lay them by. Those will be our scrapers. If we had more time, we could make handles, but we don't. Our hands will be plenty sore by bedtime.
How long do you think it'll take to get enough scrapers?
Not so long, Roland said. Chert breaks lucky, or so I used to hear. While Roland dragged deadwood for a fire into a copse of mixed willows and alders by the edge of the frozen stream, Susanna inspected her way along the embankments, looking for chert. By the time she'd found a dozen large chunks, she had also located a granite boulder rising from the ground in a smooth, weather-worn curve. She thought it would make a fine anvil. The chert did indeed break lucky, and she had 30 potential scrapers by the time Roland was bringing back his third large load of firewood. He made a little pile of kindling, which Susanna shielded with her hands. By then it was sleeting, and although they were working beneath a fairly dense clump of trees, she thought it wouldn't be long before both of them were soaked. When the fire was lit, Roland went a few steps away, once more fell on his knees, and folded his hands.
"Praying again?" she asked, amused.
"What we learn in our childhood, as a way of sticking," he said. He closed his eyes for a few moments, then brought his clasped hands to his mouth and kissed them. The only word she heard him say was, "Gan." Then he opened his eyes and lifted his hands, spreading them and making a pretty gesture that looked to her like birds flying away. When he spoke again, his voice was dry and matter-of-fact. "Mister taking care of business." "That's very well, then," he said. "Let's go to work." 7. They made twine from grass, just as Mordred had done, and hung the first deer, the one already headless, by its back legs from the low branch of a willow. Roland used his knife to cut its belly open, then reached into the guts, rummaged, and removed two dripping red organs that she thought were kidneys. "These for fever and cough," he said, and bit into the first one as if it were an apple. Susanna made a gurking noise and turned away to consider the stream until he was finished. When he was, she turned back and watched him cut circles around the hanging legs close to where they joined the body.
"Are you any better?"
she asked him uneasily. "I will be," he said. "Now help me take the hide off this fellow. We'll want the first one with the hair still on it. We need to make a bowl for our slurry. Now watch." He worked his fingers into the place where the deer's hide still clung to the body by the thin layer of fat and muscle beneath, then pulled. The hide tore easily to a point halfway down the deer's midsection. "Now do your side, Susanna." Getting her fingers underneath was the only hard part. This time they pulled together, and when they had the hide all the way down to the dangling forelegs, it vaguely resembled a shirt. Roland used his knife to cut it off, then began to dig in the ground, a little way from the roaring fire, but still beneath the shelter of the trees. She helped him, relishing the way the sweat rolled down her face and body. When they had a shallow, bowl-shaped depression 2 feet across and 18 inches deep, Roland lined it with the hide. All that afternoon, they took turns skinning the 8 other deer they had killed. It was important to do it as quickly as possible, for when the underlying layer of fat and muscle dried up, the work would become slower and harder. The gunslinger kept the fire burning high and hot, every now and then leaving her to rake ashes out onto the ground. When they had cooled enough so they would not burn holes in their bowl liner, he pushed them into the hole they'd made. Susanna's back and arms were aching fiercely by 5 o'clock, but she kept at it. Roland's face neck and hands were comically smeared with ash. "You look like a fella in a minstrel show," she said at one point. "Rastus Coon."
"Who's that?"
"Nobody but the white folks, fool," she said. "Do you suppose Mordred's out there watching us work?"
All day she'd kept an eye peeled for him.
"No,"
he said, pausing to rest. He brushed his hair back from his forehead, leaving a fresh smear and now making her think of penitence on Ash Wednesday.
"I think he's gone off to make his own kill."
"Mordred's a-hungry," she said. And then, "You can touch him a little, can't you? At least enough to know if he's here or if he's gone."
Roland considered this, then said simply, "I'm his father." 8. By dark, they had a large heap of deerskins and a pile of skinned, headless carcasses that surely would have been black with flies in warmer weather. They ate another huge meal of sizzling venison steaks, utterly delicious, and Susanna spared another thought for Mordred, somewhere out in the dark, probably eating his own supper raw. He might have matches, but he wasn't stupid. If they saw another fire in all this darkness, they would rush down upon it, and him. Then bang, 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 goodbye, Spider-Boy. She felt a surprising amount of sympathy for him, and told herself to beware of it. Certainly he would have felt none for either her or Roland, had the shoe been on the other foot. When they were done eating, Roland wiped his greasy fingers on his shirt and said,
"That tasted fine."
"You got that right."
"Now let's get the brains out, then we'll sleep."
"One at a time?" Susanna asked.
"Yes. So far as I know, brains only come one to a customer."
For a moment, she was too surprised at hearing Eddie's phrase, "one to a customer," coming from Roland's mouth to realize he'd made a joke. Lame, yes, but a bona fide joke. Then she managed a token laugh.
"Very funny, Roland. You know what I meant."
Roland nodded.
"We'll sleep one at a time, and stand a watch, yes. I think that would be best."
Time and repetition had done its work. She'd now seen too many tumbling guts to feel squeamish about a few brains. They cracked heads, used Roland's knife, its edge now dull, to pry open skulls, and removed the brains of their kill. These they put carefully aside, like a clutch of large gray eggs. By the time the last deer was debrained, Susanna's fingers were so sore and swollen she could hardly bend them.
"Lie over," Roland said. "Sleep. I'll take the first watch."
She didn't argue. Given her full belly and the heat of the fire, she knew sleep would come quickly. She also knew that when she woke up tomorrow, she was going to be so stiff that even sitting up would be difficult and painful. Now, though, she didn't care. A feeling of vast contentment filled her. Some of it was having eaten hot food, but by no means all. The greater part of her well-being stemmed from a day of hard work, no more or less than that. The sense that they were not just floating along, but doing for themselves.
"Jesus," she thought, "I think I'm becoming a Republican in my old age."
Something else occurred to her then. How quiet it was. No sounds, but the sough of the wind, the whispering sleet now starting to abate, and the crackle of the blessed fire. "Roland?" He looked at her from his place by the fire, eyebrows raised.
"You've stopped coughing."
He smiled and nodded. She took his smile down into sleep. But it was Eddie she dreamed of. 9. They stayed 3 days in the camp by the stream, and during that time Susanna learned more about making hide garments than she would ever have believed, and much more than she really wanted to know. By casting a mile or so in either direction along the stream, they found a couple of logs, one for each of them. While they looked, they used their makeshift pot to soak their hides in a dark soup of ash and water. They set their logs at an angle against the trunks of 2 willow trees, close, so they could work side by side, and used chert scrapers to dehair the hides. This took one day, When it was done, they bailed out the pot, turned the hide liner over, and filled it up again, this time with a mixture of water and mashed brains. This cold-weather hiding was new to her. They put the hides in this slurry to soak overnight, and while Susanna began to make thread from strings of gristle and sinew, Roland resharpened his knife, then used it to whittle half a dozen bone needles. When he was done, all of his fingers were bleeding from dozens of shallow cuts. He coated them with wood ash soak and slept with them that way, his hands looking as if they were covered with large and clumsy gray-black gloves. When he washed them off in a stream the following day, Susanna was amazed to see the cuts already well on their way to healing. She tried dabbing some of the wood ash stuff on the persistent sore beside her mouth, but it stung horribly, and she washed it away in a hurry. "I want you to wipe this goddamn thing off," she said. Roland shook his head. "We'll give it a little longer to heal on its own."
"Why?"
"Cutting on a sore's a bad idea unless you absolutely have to do it, especially out here in what Jake would have called the boondogs." She agreed, without bothering to correct his pronunciation, but unpleasant images crept into her head when she lay down. Visions of the pimple beginning to spread, erasing her face inch by inch, turning her entire head into a black, crusted, bleeding tumor. In the dark, such visions had a horrible persuasiveness, but luckily she was too tired for them to keep her awake long. On their second day in what Susanna was coming to think of as the hide camp, Roland built a large and rickety frame over a new fire, one that was low and slow. They smoked the hides two by two and then laid them aside. The smell of the finished product was surprisingly pleasant. "It smells like leather," she thought, holding one to her face, and then had to laugh. That was, after all, exactly what it was. The third day they spent making, and here Susanna finally outdid the gunslinger. Roland sewed a wide and barely serviceable stitch. She thought that the vests and leggings he made would hold together for a month, two at the most, then begin to pull apart. She was far more adept. Sewing was a skill she'd learned from her mother and both grandmothers. At first she found Roland's bone needles maddeningly clumsy, and she paused long enough to cover both the thumb and forefinger of her right hand with little deerskin caps which she tied in place. After that it went faster, and by mid-afternoon of making day she was taking garments from Roland's pile and over-sewing his stitches with her own, which were finer and closer. She thought he might object to this. Men were proud, but he didn't, which was probably wise. It quite likely would have been Detta who replied to any whines and queasies. By the time their third night in hide camp had come, they each had a vest, a pair of leggings, and a coat. They also had a pair of mittens each. These were large and laughable, but would keep their hands warm. And speaking of hands, Susanna was once more barely able to bend hers. She looked doubtfully at the remaining hides and asked Roland if they would spend another making day here. He considered the idea, then shook his head. "We'll load the ones that are left into the Hofat taxi, I think, along with some of the meat and chunks of ice from the stream to keep it cool and good."
"The taxi won't be any good when we come to the snow, will it?"
"No," he admitted. "But by then the rest of the hides will be clothing and the meat will be eaten."
"You just can't stay here any longer, that's what it comes down to, isn't it? You hear it calling. The tower."
Roland looked into the snapping.
"What'll we do about hauling our gunner when we come to the White Lands?"
"Make a travoy, and there'll be plenty of game." She nodded and started to lie down. He took her shoulders and turned her toward the fire instead. His face came close to hers, and for a moment Susanna thought he meant to kiss her goodnight. He looked long and hard at the crusted sore beside her mouth instead.
"Well?"
she finally asked. She could have said more, but he would have heard the tremor in her voice. "I think it's a little smaller. Once we leave the Badlands behind, it may heal on its own."
"Do you really say so?"
The gunslinger shook his head at once. "I say may.
Now lie over, Susanna. Take your rest.
All right. But don't you let me sleep late this time. I want to watch my share.
Yes. Now lie over.
She did as he said, and was asleep even before her eyes closed. 10. She's in Central Park, and it's cold enough to see her breath. The sky overhead is white from side to side, a snow sky, but she's not cold. No, not in her new deerskin coat, leggings, vest, and funny deerskin mittens. There's something on her head, too, pulled down over her ears and keeping them as toasty as the rest of her. She takes the cap off, curious, and sees it's not deerskin like the rest of her new clothing, but a red and green stocking cap. Written across the front is, Merry Christmas. She looks at it, startled. Can you have deja vu in a dream? Apparently so. She looks around, and there are Eddie and Jake grinning at her. Their heads are bare, and she realizes she has in her hands a combination of the caps they were wearing in some other dream. She feels a great, soaring burst of joy, as if she has just solved some supposedly insoluble problem. Squaring the circle, let us say, or finding the ultimate prime number. Take that, Blaine, may it bust your brain, you crazy choo-choo train. Eddie is wearing a sweatshirt that says, I drink Nozzola. Jake is wearing one that says, I drive the Takuro Spirit. Both have cups of hot chocolate, the perfect kind, mit Schlag on top and little sprinkles of nutmeg dotting the cream. What world is this? She asks them, and realizes that somewhere nearby carolers are singing, What child is this?
You must let him go his course alone, says Eddie.
Yar, and you must beware of Dandolo, says Jake. I don't understand, Susanna says, and holds out her stocking cap to them. Wasn't this yours? Didn't you share it? It could be your hat if you want it, says Eddie, and then holds out his cup. Here, I brought you hot chocolate. No more twins, says Jake. There's only one hat, do you not see?
Before she can reply, a voice speaks out of the air and the dream begins to unravel. 19, says the voice.
This is 19. This is Chasset.
With each word, the world becomes more unreal. She can see through Eddie and Jake. The good smell of hot chocolate is fading, being replaced by the smell of ash, Wednesday, and leather. She sees Eddie's lips moving, and she thinks he's saying a name, and then...
11. Time to get up, Susanna, Roland said. It's your watch.
She sat up, looking around. The campfire had burned low.
I heard him moving out there, Roland said, but that was some time ago. Susanna, are you all right? Were you dreaming?
Yes, she said. There was only one hat in this dream, and I was wearing it.
I don't understand you. Nor did she understand herself. The dream was already fading, as dreams do. All she knew for sure was that the name on Eddie's lips, just before he faded away for good, had been that of Patrick Danville.
Chapter 5. Joe Collins of Odd's Lane. 1. 3 weeks after the dream of one hat, three figures, two large, one small, emerged from a tract of upland forest and began to move slowly across a great open field toward more woods below. One of the large figures was pulling the other on a contraption that was more sled than travoy. Oi raced back and forth between Roland and Susanna as if keeping a constant watch. His fur was thick and sleek from cold weather and a constant diet of deer meat. The land the three of them were currently covering might have been a meadow in the warmer seasons, but now the ground was buried under 5 feet of snow. The pulling was easier because their way was finally leading downward. Roland actually dared hope the worst was over. and crossing the White Lands had not been too bad, at least not yet. There was plenty of game, there was plenty of wood for their nightly fire, and on the four occasions when the weather turned nasty and blizzards blew, they had simply laid up and waited for the storms to wear themselves out on the wooded ridges that marched southeast. Eventually they did, although the angriest of these blizzards lasted 2 full days. And when they once more took to the path of the beam, they found another 3 feet of new snow on the ground. In the open places, where the shrieking northeast wind had been able to rage fully, there were drifts like ocean waves. Some of these had buried tall pines almost to their tops. After their first day in the White Lands, with Roland struggling to pull her, and then the snow had been less than a foot deep, Susanna saw that they were apt to spend months crossing those high, forested ridges unless Roland had a pair of snowshoes. So that first night, she'd set out to make him a pair. It was a trial-and-error process. By guess and by gosh, was how Susanna put it. But the gunslinger pronounced her third effort a success. The frames were made of limber birch branches, the centers of woven, overlapping deerskin strips. To Roland, they looked like teardrops. "How did you know to do this?" he asked her, after his first day of wearing them. The increase in distance covered was nothing short of amazing, especially once he had learned to walk with a kind of rolling shipboard stride that kept the snow from accumulating on the latticed surfaces.
"Television," Susanna said. "There used to be this program I watched when I was a kid, Sergeant Preston of the Yukon. Sergeant Preston didn't have a Billy Bumber to keep him company, but he did have his faithful dog, King. Anyway, I closed my eyes and tried to remember what the guy's snowshoes looked like."
She pointed to the ones Roland was wearing.
"That's the best I could do."
"You did fine," he said, and the sincerity she heard in his simple compliment made her tingle all over. This was not necessarily the way she wanted Roland, or any other man for that matter, to make her feel, but she seemed stuck with it. She wondered if that was nature or nurture, and wasn't sure she wanted to know.
"They'll be all right as long as they don't fall apart," she allowed. Her first effort had done just that.
"I don't feel the strips loosening," he told her. "Stretching a little, maybe, but that's all." Now, as they crossed the great open space, that third pair of snowshoes was still holding together. And because she felt as though she'd made some sort of contribution, Susanna was able to let Roland pull her along without too much guilt. She did wonder about Mordred from time to time, and one night about 10 days after they had crossed the snow boundary, she came out and asked Roland to tell her what he knew. What prompted her was his declaration that there was no need to set a watch, at least for a while. They could both get a full 10 hours' worth of sleep, if that's what their bodies could use. Oi would wake them if they needed waking. Roland had sighed and looked into the fire for nearly a full minute, his arms around his knees, and his hands clasped loosely between them. She had just about decided he wasn't going to answer at all when he said, "Still following, but falling further and further behind. Struggling to eat, struggling to catch up, struggling most of all to stay warm."
"To stay warm?"
To Susanna this seemed hard to believe. There were trees all around them. "He has no matches. And none of the sterno stuff, either. I believe that one night, early on this would have been, he came upon one of our fires with live coals still under the ash, and he was able to carry some with him for a few days after that, and so have a fire at night. It's how the ancient rock dwellers used to carry fire on their journeys, or so I was told." Susanna nodded. She had been taught roughly the same thing in a high school science class. Although the teacher had admitted a lot of what they knew about how Stone Age people got along wasn't true knowledge at all, but only informed guesswork. She wondered how much of what Roland had just told her was also guesswork. And so she asked him. "It's not guessing, but I can't explain it. If it's the touch, Susanna, it's not such as Jake had. Not seeing and hearing or even dreaming, although, do you believe we have dreams sometimes we don't remember after we awaken?"
"Yes."
She thought of telling him about rapid eye movement and the REM sleep experiments she'd read about in Look magazine, then decided it would be too complex.
She contented herself with saying that she was sure folks had dreams every single night that they didn't remember.
"Mayhap I see him and hear him in those," Roland said. "All I know is that he's struggling to keep up. He knows so little about the world that it's really a wonder he's still alive at all."
"Do you feel sorry for him?"
"No. I can't afford pity. And neither can you." But his eyes had left hers when he said that, and she thought he was lying. Maybe he didn't want to feel sorry for Mordred, but she was sure he did, at least a little. Maybe he wanted to hope that Mordred would die on their trail. Certainly there were plenty of chances it would happen, with hypothermia being the most likely cause. But Susanna didn't think he was quite able to do it. They might have outrun Kaa, but she reckoned that blood was still thicker than water. There was something else, however, more powerful than even the blood of relation. She knew, because she could now feel it beating in her own head, both sleeping and waking. It was the Dark Tower. She thought that they were very close to it now. She had no idea what they were going to do about its mad guardian when and if they got there, but she found she no longer cared. For the present, all she wanted was to see it. The idea of entering it was still more than her imagination could deal with, but seeing it, yes, she could imagine that. And she thought that seeing it would be enough. 2. They made their way slowly down the wide, white downslope, with Oi first hurrying at Roland's heel, then dropping behind to check on Susanna, then bounding back to Roland again. Bright blue holes sometimes opened above them. Roland knew that was the beam at work, constantly pulling the cloud cover southeast. Otherwise, the sky was white from horizon to horizon and had a low, full look both of them now recognized. More snow was on the come, and the gunslinger had an idea this storm might be the worst they'd seen. The wind was getting up, and the moisture in it was enough to numb all his exposed skin. After 3 weeks of diligent needlework, that amounted to not much more than his forehead and the tip of his nose. The gusts lifted long, diaphanous scarves of white. These raced past them and then on down the slope like fantastical, shape-changing ballet dancers.
"They're beautiful, aren't they?" Susanna asked from behind him, almost wistfully.
Roland of Gilead, no judge of beauty except once in the Outland of Magus, grunted. He knew what would be beautiful to him. Decent cover when the storm overtook them. Something more than just a thick grove of trees. So he almost doubted what he saw when the latest gust of wind blew itself out and the snow settled. He dropped the tow band, stepped out of it, went back to Susanna, their gunner, now on the increase again, was strapped to the sledge behind her, and dropped on one knee next to her. Dressed in hides from top to toe, he looked more like a mangy Bigfoot than a man. "What do you make of that?" he asked her. The wind kicked up again, harder than ever, at first obscuring what he had seen. When it dropped, a hole opened above them, and the sun shone briefly through, lighting the snow field with billions of diamond-chipped sparkles. Susanna shaded her eyes with one hand and looked long downhill. What she saw was an inverted T carved in the snow. The cross arm, closest to them, but still at least 2 miles away, was relatively short, perhaps 200 feet on either side. The long arm, however, was very long, going all the way to the horizon and then disappearing over it.
"Those are roads," she said. "Someone's plowed a couple of roads down there, Roland."
He nodded. "I thought so. But I wanted to hear you say it. I see something else as well."
"What? Your eyes are sharper than mine, and by a lot."
"When we get a little closer, you'll see for yourself." He tried to rise, and she tugged impatiently at his arm.
"Don't you play that game with me. What is it?"
"Roofs," he said, giving in to her. "I think there are cottages down there. Mayhap even a town."
"People? Are you saying people?"
"Well, it looks like there's smoke coming from one of the houses. Although it's hard to tell for sure with the sky so white." She didn't know if she wanted to see people or not. Certainly, such would complicate things.
"Roland, we'll have to be careful."
"Yes," he said,
and went back to the tow band again. Before he picked it up, he paused to readjust his gun belt, dropping the holster a bit so it lay more comfortably near his left hand. An hour later, they came to the intersection of the lane and the road. It was marked by a snowbank easily 11 feet high, one that had been built by some sort of plow. Susanna could see tread marks, like those made by a bulldozer, pressed into the packed snow. Rising out of this hard pack was a pole. The street sign on top was no different from those she'd seen in all sorts of towns, at intersections in New York City, for that matter. The one indicating the short road said, "Odd's Lane." It was the other that thrilled her heart, however. "Tower Road," it read. 3. All but one of the cottages clustered around the intersection were deserted, and many lay in half-buried heaps, broken beneath the weight of accumulating snow. One, however, it was about three-quarters of the way down the left-hand arm of Odd's Lane, was clearly different from the others. The roof had been mostly cleared of its potentially crushing weight of snow, and a path had been shoveled from the lane to the front door. It was from the chimney of this quaint tree-surrounded cottage that the smoke was issuing, feather-white. One window was lit a wholesome butter-yellow, too, but it was the smoke that captured Susanna's eye. As far as she was concerned, it was the final touch. The only question in her mind was who would answer the door when they knocked. Would it be Hansel or his sister Gretel? And were those two twins? Had anyone ever researched the matter? Perhaps it would be Little Red Riding Hood, or Goldilocks, wearing a guilty goatee of porridge. "Maybe we should just pass it by," she said, aware that she had dropped her voice to a near whisper, even though they were still on the high snowbank created by the plow. "Give it a miss and say thank you." She gestured to the sign reading Tower Road. "We've got a clear way, Roland. Maybe we ought to take it."
"And if we should, do you think that Mordred will?" Roland asked. "Do you think he'll simply pass by and leave whoever lives there in peace?" Here was a question that hadn't even occurred to her, and of course the answer was no. If Mordred decided he could kill whoever was in the cottage, he'd do it. For food, if the inhabitants were edible, but food would only be a secondary consideration. The woods behind them had been teeming with game, and even if Mordred hadn't been able to catch his own supper, and in his spider form, Susanna was sure he would have been perfectly capable of doing that. They had left the remains of their own meals at a good many camps. No. He would come out of the snowy uplands fed, but not happy. Not happy at all. And so, woe to whoever happened to be in his path. On the other hand, she thought, only there was no other hand. And all at once it was too late anyway. The front door of the cottage opened, and an old man came out onto the stoop. He was wearing boots, jeans, and a heavy parka with a fur-lined hood. To Susanna, this latter garment looked like something that might have been purchased at the Army-Navy surplus store in Greenwich Village. The old man was rosy-cheeked, the picture of wintry good health, but he limped heavily, depending on the stout stick in his left hand. From behind his quaint little cottage, with its fairy-tale plume of smoke, came the piercing whinny of a horse.
"Sure, Lippy, I see 'em," the old man cried, turning in that direction. "I got at least one good eye left, ain't I?"
Then he turned back to where Roland stood on the snowbank with Susanna and Oi flanking him. He raised his stick in a salute that seemed both merry and unafraid. Roland raised his own hand in return.
"Looks like we're in for some palaver whether we want it or not," said Roland.
"I know," she replied. Then to the bumbler, "Oi, mind your manners now, you hear?"
Oi looked at her, and then back at the old man without making a sound. On the subject of minding his manners, he'd keep his own counsel a while, it seemed. The old man's bad leg was clearly very bad. "Next door to nothing," Daddy Moe's carver would have said. But he got on well enough with his stick, moving in a sideways hopping gait that Susanna found both amusing and admirable. "Spry as a cricket" was another of Daddy Moe's many sayings, and perhaps this one fit yonder old man better. Certainly she saw no harm or danger in a white-haired fellow, the hair was long and baby fine, hanging to the shoulders of his anorak, who had to hop along on a stick. And as he drew closer, she saw that one of his eyes was filmed white with a cataract. The pupil, which was faintly visible, seemed to look dully off to their left. The other, however, regarded the newcomers with lively interest as the inhabitant of the cottage hopped down Odd's Lane toward them. The horse whinnied again, and the old man waved his stick wildly against the white, low-lying sky.
"Shut up, you hay box, you turd factory, you old clap-cunt gammer-girt! Ain't you ever seen company before? Was you born in a barn? He-he! For if you wasn't, I'm a blue-eyed baboon, which there ain't no such thing!"
Roland snorted with genuine laughter, and the last of Susanna's watchful apprehension departed. The horse whinnied again from the outbuilding behind the cottage. It was nowhere near grand enough to be called a barn, and the old man waved his stick at it once more, almost falling to the snowpack in the process. His awkward but nonetheless rapid gait had now brought him halfway to their location. He saved himself from what would have been a nasty tumble, took a large sidle hop using the stick for a prop, then waved it cheerily in their direction.
"Hiya, gunslingers!" the old man shouted.
His lungs, at least, were admirable.
"Gunslingers on pilgrimage to the Dark Tower, so you are, so you must be. For don't I see the big irons with the yellow grips? And the beam be back, fair and strong, for I feel it, and Lippy do too. Spry as a colt she's been ever since Christmas, or what I call Christmas, not having a calendar, nor seen Santa Claus, which I wouldn't expect, for have I been a good boy? Never, never. Good boys go to heaven, and all my friends be into other place, toasting marshmallows and drinking nozzers spiked with whiskey in the devil's den. Never mind, my tongue's caught in the middle and runs on both ends. Hile to one, hile to t'other, and hile to the little furry gobbins in between. Billy Bumblers, I live and breathe. Yeah, ain't it good to see you? Joe Collins is my name, Joe Collins of Odd's Lane. Plenty odd myself, one-eyed and lame I am, but otherwise at your service."
He had now reached the snowbank marking the spot where Tower Road ended, or where it began, depending on your point of view and the direction you were traveling, Susanna supposed. He looked up at them, one eye bright as a bird's, the other looking off into the white wastes with dull fascination.
"Long days and pleasant nights, yeah, so say I. And anyone who'd say different, they ain't here anyway, so who gives a good goddamn what they say?"
From his pocket he took what could only be a gumdrop, and tossed it up. Oi grabbed it out of the air easily, snap, and gone. At this, both Roland and Susanna laughed. It felt strange to laugh, but it was a good feeling, like finding something of value long after you were sure it was lost forever. Even Oi appeared to be grinning, and if the horse bothered him, it trumpeted again as they looked down on Cy Collins from their snowbank perch, it didn't show.
"I got a million questions for you," Collins said, "but I'll start with just one. How in the hell are yous going to get down off of that snowbank?"
4. As it turned out, Susanna slid down, using their travoy as a sled. She chose the place where the northwestern end of Odd's Lane disappeared beneath the snow because the embankment was a little shallower there. Her trip was short but not smooth. She hit a large and crusted snow boulder three-quarters of the way down, fell off the travoy, and made the rest of her descent in a pair of gaudy somersaults, laughing wildly as she fell. The travoy turned over, turned turtle, may it do you, and spilled their gunna every which way and held to breakfast. Roland and Oi came leaping down behind. Roland bent over her at once, clearly concerned, and Oi sniffed anxiously at her face, but Susanna was still laughing. So was the codger. Daddy Mose would have called his laughter gay as old Dad's hatband.
"I'm fine, Roland. Took worse tumbles off my flexible flyer when I was a kid, tell you true."
"All's well that ends well," Joe Collins agreed.
He gave her a look with his good eye to make sure she was indeed all right, then began to pick up some of the scattered goods, leaning laboriously over on his stick, his fine white hair blowing around his rosy face. Nah, Roland said, reaching out to grasp his arm. "I'll do that. You'll fall on my fiddles." At this the old man roared with laughter, and Roland joined him willingly enough. From behind the cottage, the horse gave another loud whinny, as if protesting all this good humor.
Fall on thy fiddles, man, that's a good one. I don't have the veriest clue under heaven what my fiddles are, yet it's a good one. Ain't it just?
He brushed the snow off Susanna's hide coat, while Roland quickly picked up the spilled goods and stacked them back on their makeshift sled. Oi helped, bringing several wrapped packages of meat in his jaws and dropping them on the back of the travoy.
That's a smart little beastie, Joe Collins said admiringly.
He's been a good trail mate, Susanna agreed.
She was now very glad they had stopped, would not have deprived herself of this good-natured old man's acquaintance for worlds. She offered him her clumsily clad right hand.
I'm Susanna Dean, Susanna of New York, daughter of Dan.
He took her hand and shook it. His own hand was ungloved, and although the fingers were gnarled with arthritis, his grip was strong.
New York, is it? Why, I once hailed from there myself, also Akron, Omaha, and San Francisco. Son of Henry and Flora, if it matters to you.
You're from America's side? Susanna asked.
Oh, God, yes, but long ago and long, he said. What you might call de la.
His good eyes sparkled. His bad eye went on regarding the snowy wastes with that same dead lack of interest. He turned to Roland.
And who might you be, my friend? For I'll call you my friend same as I would anyone, unless they prove different, in which case I'd belt him with Bessie, which is what I call my stick.
Roland was grinning. Was helpless not to, Susanna thought. Roland Deschain of Gilead, son of Stephen.
Gilead? Gilead?
Collins's good eye went round with amazement.
There's a name out of the past, ain't it? One for the books. Holy Pete, you must be older than God.
Some would say so, Roland agreed, now only smiling, but warmly.
And the little fellow?
He asked, bending forward. From his pocket, Collins produced two more gumdrops, one red and one green. Christmas colors, and Susanna felt a faint touch of deja vu. It brushed her mind like a wing and then was gone.
What's your name, little fella? What do they holler when they want you to come home?
He doesn't talk anymore, although he did once, was how Susanna meant to finish. But before she could, the bumbler said,
Oi!
And he said it as brightly and firmly as ever in his time with Jake.
Good fella!
Collins said, and tumbled the gumdrops into Oi's mouth. Then he reached out with that same gnarled hand, and Oi raised his paw to meet it. They shook, well met near the intersection of Odds Lane and Tower Road.
I'll be damned, Roland said mildly.
So won't we all in the end, I reckon, beam or no beam, Joe Collins remarked, letting go of Oi's paw. But not today. Now what I say is that we ought to get in where it's warm, and we can palaver over a cup of coffee. For I have some, so I do, or a pot of ale. I even have something I call eggnog, if it does you. It does me pretty fine, especially with a teensy piss of rum in it, but who knows? I ain't really tasted nothing in 5 years or more. Air out of the Discordia's done for my taste buds and for my nose, too. Anyrow, what do you say?
He regarded them brightly.
I'd say that sounds pretty damned fine. Susanna told him. Rarely had she said anything she meant more.
He slapped her companionably on the shoulder.
A good woman is a pearl beyond price. Don't know if that's Shakespeare, the Bible, or a combination of the two. Ah, Lippy, goddamn what used to be your eyes. Where do you think you're going? Did you want to meet these folks, was that it?
His voice had fallen into the outrageous croon that seems the exclusive property of people who live alone except for a pet or two. His horse had blundered its way to them, and Collins grabbed her around the neck, petting her with rough affection, but Susanna thought the beast was the ugliest quadruped she'd seen in her whole life. Some of her good cheer melted away at the sight of the thing. Lippy was blind, not in one eye but in both, and scrawny as a scarecrow. As she walked, the rack of her bones shifted back and forth so clearly beneath her mangy coat that Susanna almost expected some of them to poke through. For a moment she remembered the black corridor under Castle Discordia with a kind of nightmarish total recall. The slithering sound of the thing that had followed them, and the bones. All those bones. Collins might have seen some of this on her face, for when he spoke again he sounded almost defensive.
Her an ugly old thing, I know, but when you get as old as she is, I don't reckon you'll be winning many beauty contests yourself."
He patted the horse's chafed and sore-looking neck, then seized her scant mane as if to pull the hair out by the roots, although Lippy showed no pain, and turned her in the road so she was facing the cottage again. As he did this, the first flakes of the coming storm skirled down.
"Come on, Lippy, you old kai-box and gammer-girt, you sway-backed nag and lost four-legged leper. Can't you smell the snow in the air? Because I can, and my nose went south years ago."
He turned back to Roland and Susanna and said,
"I hope you prove partial to my cooking, so I do, because I think this is going to be a 3-day blow. Aye, 3 at least, before Demon Moon shows her face again. But we're well met, so we are, and I set my watch and warrant on it. You just don't want to judge my hospitality by my horsepitality, heh?"
"I should hope not," Susanna thought, and gave a little shiver. The old man had turned away, but Roland gave her a curious look. She smiled and shook her head as if to say, "It's nothing," which of course it was. She wasn't about to tell the gunslinger that a spavined nag with cataracts on her eyes and her ribs showing had given her a case of the whim-whams. Roland had never called her a silly goose, and by God she didn't mean to give him cause to do so now. As if hearing her thoughts, the old nag looked back and bared her few remaining teeth at Susanna. The eyes in Lippy's bony wedge of a head were pus-rimmed plugs of blindness above her somehow gruesome grin. She whinnied at Susanna as if to say, "Think what you will, Blackbird, I'll be here long after thee's gone thy course and died thy death." At the same time the wind gusted, swirling snow in their faces, stuffing in the snow-laden firs, and hooting beneath the eaves of Collins's little house. It began to die away and then strengthened again for a moment, making a brief, grieving cry that sounded almost human. 5. The outbuilding consisted of a chicken coop on one side, Lippy's stall on the other, and a little loft stuffed with hay.
"I can get up there and fork it down," Colin said, "but I take my life in my hands every time I do, thanks to this bust hip of mine. Now, I can't make you help an old man," sighed Deshane, "but if you would—"
Roland climbed the ladder, resting a tilt against the edge of the loft floor, and tossed down hay until Collins told him it was good, plenty enough to last Lippy through even 4 days' worth of blow.
"For she don't eat worth what you might call a Polish fuck, as you can see looking at her," he said.
Then the gunslinger came back down, and Collins led them along the short back walk to his cottage. The snow piled on either side was as high as Roland's head.
"Be it ever so humble, etc.,"
Joe said, and ushered them into his kitchen. It was paneled in knotty pine, which was actually plastic, Susanna saw when she got closer, and it was delightfully warm. The name on the electric stove was Roscoe, a brand she'd never heard of. The fridge was an Amana and had a special little door set into the front above the handle. She leaned closer and saw the words, "Magic Ice."
"This thing makes ice cubes?" she asked, delighted.
"Well, no, not exactly," Joe said. "It's the freezer that makes them, beauty. That thing on the front just drops them into your drink."
This struck her funny, and she laughed. She looked down, saw Oi looking up at her with his old fiendish grin, and that made her laugh harder than ever. Mod cons aside, the smell of the kitchen was wonderfully nostalgic. Sugar and spice and everything nice. Roland was looking up at the fluorescent lights, and Collins nodded.
Yeah, I got all the electric," he said. "Hot air furnace, too, ain't it nice? And nobody ever sends me a bill. The Jenny's in a shed round to t'other side. It's a Honda, and quiet as Sunday morning. Even when you get right up on top of its little shed, you don't hear nothing but, Stuttering Bill changes the propane tank and does the maintenance when it needs maintaining, which hasn't been but twice in all the time I've been here. Nope, Joey's lying, he'll soon be dying. 3 times it's been, 3 in all."
"Who's Stuttering Bill?" Susanna asked, just as Roland was asking, "How long have you been here?" Joe Collins laughed.
"One at a time, me fine new friends, one at a time."
He had set his stick aside to struggle out of his coat, put his weight on his bad leg, made a low snarling sound, and nearly fell over. Would have fallen over had Roland not steadied him.
Thank ye, Joe said. Although I tell you what, it wouldn't have been the first time I wound up with my nose on that linoleum. But as you saved me a tumble, it's your question I'll answer first. I've been here, Odd Joe of Odd's Lane, just about 17 years. The only reason I can't tell you bang on is that for a while there, time got pretty goddamn funny, if you know what I mean.
We do, Susanna said. Believe me, we do.
Collins was now divesting himself of a sweater, and beneath it was another. Susanna's first impression had been of a stout old man who stopped just short of fat. Now she saw that a lot of what she'd taken for fat was nothing but padding. He wasn't as desperately scrawny as his old horse, but he was a long shout from stout.
"Now, Stuttering Bill,"
the old man continued, removing the second sweater,
"he be a robot. Cleans the house as well as keeping my generator running. And, of course, he's the one that does the plowing. When I first come here, he only stuttered once in a while. Now, it's every second or third word. What I'll do when he finally runs down, I don't know."
To Susanna's ear, he sounded singularly unworried about it.
"Maybe he'll get better now that the beam's working right again," she said.
"He might last a little longer, but I doubt like hell that he'll get any better," Joe said. "Machines don't heal the way living things do."
He'd finally reached his thermal undershirt, and here the strip-down stopped. Susanna was grateful. Looking at the somehow ghastly barrel of the horse's ribs, so close beneath the short gray fur, had been enough. She had no wish to see the master's as well.
"Off with your coats and your leggings," Joe said. "I'll get you eggnog or whatever else you'd like in a minute or two, but first I'd show you my living room. For it's my pride, so it is."